2 hours now, your special Tux with Bob Zimmerman. Some of his works, the Chronological Encyclopedia of Discoveries in Space, Leaving Earth, Space Stations, Rival Superpowers, and the Quest for Interplanetary Travel. Genesis, the story of Apollo 8, the universe in a mirror. Bob Zimmerman, our guest, your calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, we're with Bob Zimmerman and your phone calls. Bob, truly, space is gorgeous, isn't it? I mean, it is truly amazing.
You know, the Hubble images say it all. I like to say this over and over and over again. The universe is a magnificent place. We are blessed to live in such a majesty. And the more we explore it, the more majestic it appears. The best Hubble images, forget about not just Hubble, you know, Cassini orbiting Saturn. I mean, the pictures of Saturn and Titan, and it's just amazing. And all the Mars pictures, it's just, you're looking at beautiful things. I love traveling out to the Southwest for vacation, the American Southwest, that beautiful stark southern south desert country. Well, Mars, it's like it beats the Grand Canyon by far. If we could walk along the rim of Valles Marineris, that thing is as big as the United States continent, no less the Grand Canyon. I mean, so yes, the universe is a spectacular place, and all that what we've learned in the last 40 years is that we are blessed to live in a magnificent universe, that the more closer we look at it, the clearer we can see it, the better it looks.
Ever since Hubble took that deep field picture, they're now estimating 50 billion galaxies.
Oh, that number.
And I bet that's small. Yeah.
The thing is, the deeper they look, the more they always find. And so I would bet, George, that number is small. It's not even, it's more than that.
When stars are born, why does it look like that they are in some kind of pod, almost like a cocoon?
The proplyd. Well, this is natural process of consolidation of material. You have a cloud. The cloud starts to rotate, and it is angular momentum. The analogy they always give is, you know, imagine a ballerina, a figure skater, going in circles. As she brings her arms in, she'll spin faster. Well, what's happening as a cloud starts to coalesce into objects, it begins to spin. And because it spins, that tends to, like a gyro, it tends to form a disk rather than a spherical cloud. And that's why you get solar systems along a disk elliptic. And the planets form within that. But while that's happening, what you're seeing is this disk of material, what looks like, you know, from a distance, like a pod. And that's just the beginning stages of planetary formation within a solar system.
You know, stars, of course, mostly hydrogen and helium, right?
Hydrogen almost completely. Hydrogen is like, I think it's like 90%. And then helium takes up 90% of what's left. You know, it's almost, yeah.
Is there a core at all there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
They don't really understand it very well.
No.
George, last month I have, in fact, right now, the cover article of Sky and Telescope is something I wrote. And today the New York Times finally picked up on it, so that it's now news, even though I wrote about this now almost. I actually wrote it up. It came out about a month ago. The sun is in a very long, deep minimum for the last 2 years. And it's confounded the solar scientists, and I've talked with a lot of them, and I've asked them bluntly, do they understand what causes the solar cycle? And the answer is very bluntly in return, no. They have theories, but none of those theories have successfully predicted what the sun should do. So they really don't have a clear yet understanding. They know basic physics, what's going on in the core of the sun. But it's extreme. We're talking about an extremely complicated thing. When there is a sunspot, you could fit like 10 Earths within it. So we're talking about a large object, the sun. And the core is You know, it's not touchable. You can't get at it. So they're trying to understand something, and we're only in the infancy of trying to understand this stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there is a core there. It's a core of hydrogen fusing into helium. Eventually, that helium, the core will become all helium, and then the sun will go become a red giant. It'll expand because it'll start to fuse the helium into carbon and other higher, larger atoms, and then it expands, gets very big. It has a cloud around it. It becomes like a planetary nebula. It'll look pretty like all the pictures that Hubble takes. Of course, it might burn the Earth up. We hopefully will be living far away at that time, and we will, because it's a billion years from now. But yeah, there is a core. We just don't. The devil's in the details, and we're really at the infancy of understanding how this stuff works.
Well, you made the cover. What's wrong with the sun? That's your article, right?
Oh, well, it's very simple. The sun is in this long, deep minimum. They didn't predict it. It's still in this minimum. It's not producing sunspots. When the sun goes through 11-year cycle. This has been going on now. They've been tracking this closely, astronomers, now for almost 250 years, since Galileo. And every 11 years, it goes through a cycle with a lot of sunspots, a very chaotic magnetic field that's very weak. And then it dies down, and you go into the minimum, in which there are no sunspots, but the magnetic field is very strong and coherent. And in the same process, during the maximum, even though there's a lot of sunspots, there's also a lot of bright areas on the sun that are much brighter than the dark areas, and the sun gets brighter and hotter by about 0.01%, approximately. They're not exactly sure of the numbers. During the minimum, it gets dimmer, weaker. It is very likely, and scientists are beginning to get a hint of this, is that the cold that the Earth has been experiencing for the last 3 years, you know, the Earth has not been warming the last 10 years, and especially in the last 4 years, it's gone through a steep decline in temperature. It's very possible that is related to the fact that the sun is in this very long, deep minimum. Now, in the past, George, the sun has gone through a minimum, an extended minimum lasting 60 years where there were no sunspots. This is back in the 1600s, late 1600s. They called it the Maunder Minimum is the name.
And I bet we had some weird weather.
They call it the Little Ice Age. There were actually famines. There were periods where there were no summers. They think now it's because the sun was in a long extended minimum with no sunspots for almost 60 years, more than 60 years, and the sun, because the sun was dimmer, the climate of the Earth cooled. Well, we don't know yet how this process works. Once the sunspots came back around 1710, they've been very regular cycle of every 11 years. Sometimes it's a little longer, sometimes it's a little shorter, sometimes it's bigger maximum, sometimes it's a little weaker. But we're looking right now at one of the longest minimums ever recorded, and we're approaching, and it looks like it could very well be one of the weakest, the maximum that is going to come could be one of the weakest maximums ever recorded. And that could be a preliminary to another Maunder Minimum. And should that happen, global warming will not be a problem.
Not at all. As a matter of fact, our guest Robert Felix, who has written a book, Not by Fire But by Ice, says we're in the beginning stages of an ice age. He might be right.
Does he attribute that to the sun?
He has a lot of factors, and that's one of them. One of them, cooling oceans, too.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, all this discussion about global warming, one must always remember, and a lot of scientists who maybe have political agendas involved in this try to sidestep it, but you have to always remember that the number one influence on our climate, bar none, everything else, is the sun.
Yes.
And if the sun goes weak, we have a problem. And global cooling would be a lot more serious problem for human survival than global warming. Because if you get warming, it increases crop areas. You might be able to grow more crops. It's better. It makes the earth wetter. It makes it possible for more there to be more plant life. There are problems associated with it, but we can deal with those. But cooling restricts the amount of crops you can grow. It reduces crop area, and we could be facing serious starvation problems if there is a cooling. So, yes, this is the question with the sun. And the scientists, I talked to a lot of solar scientists, they don't really understand at the moment what's going on. They have adjusted their predictions for what's going to happen next, but they still really don't know what's going to happen next.
Next up, let's go to calls. Encinitas, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, Doug, go ahead. Go ahead, Doug.
Back in the 1960s, I was part of ASA, Army Security Agency, which was also under NSA. And we had a little secret base in Hawaii called Hilimano. It was northwest of Schofield Barracks. And normally we flew to the South Pacific, like Johnson Island or Midway, to monitor the Russian missile shots when they sent them off. And we'd record them, and I was running the tape recorders. Well, this one date, and I'm sure Bob knows the date, was April 12th, 1961. We set up our towers right there on the base in Hawaii, on Oahu. And the NSA guy came in. He had a little black box with him and an oscilloscope. And that little tiny round screen, George, you know, that little green-looking thing with the lines on it?
Yep.
Well, he set it up to receive a video signal. He did something to it. And right on cue, we started getting the telemetry signals from something going overhead. He turned and started messing around with some more equipment, and he told me, let him know when something comes up. Well, here comes the picture, and I'm the only American that I'm aware of who got to watch Yuri Alexeyevich Gagarin in his first, or the first man in space, live. The picture was on very briefly. He was facing right to left. And as he flew overhead, the thing I find most fascinating was his left arm moved forward and hit a switch, what looked like a switch, and it got dark. And when the tapes were studied later, we were still getting the signal, but he turned the lights off.
That's fascinating.
So these guys knew exactly where we were. Not only had their, you know, their telemetry and their signals, but
that's very fascinating. I mean, the Soviets had a camera on Gagarin during his whole flight, it doesn't surprise me that the military immediately tried to tap in on that video signal and grab it. And that's amazing you were able to watch him. It is possible then turning off his lights was actually more innocent than that, believe it or not. It could just simply have been that he had a sequence of tests he was supposed to do, such as, what is it like in weightlessness, no one's ever done this before, when the lights are out? Do cosmic rays produce any flashes in the eyes? This is actually a question which has been answered. They do. So it could have just simply been a simple experiment to see what's it like in the dark in weightlessness. And it just happened to time at the moment you were watching.
Okay, next up, we'll go to Hank, driving around in Florida. Hey, Hank, go ahead.
Good evening, George.
There you go.
That's for 40 years of it right there. I was a kid watching it, and I'll never forget it all my life. I described it to my child, and of course, it all seems old now. I've got a quick statement and a question, please.
Okay.
Friday, you had your guest on, and they were talking about all the background people in one segment, you know, everybody it took to get that mission going.
Yeah.
My uncle worked at the Arnold Space Center in Manchester, Tennessee, and he says every time he looks at the moon, he thinks about his welding. He was a master welder. He did welding on that thing that landed on the moon, and he said every time he looks at it, he's got handiwork on the moon. And I think about all the other hundreds of people that had to have some handiwork and that equipment, too, that's still up there. So,
absolutely.
He was very proud. He's retired now and everything, but he was very proud of being part of that.
Okay.
He was a civilian contractor, but he was very proud of it. Sure was.
What's your question, Hank?
My question, nearest I'll ever become an astronaut is Google Earth, which I love. I really feel like an astronaut flying over the Earth and going to spots. Can we have something reverse on the moon to show that equipment? Because I can see my daughter's boyfriend's car in my yard from Google Earth. So I guess what I'm saying is, can we Google Moon someday and see some of that equipment that's sitting there or whatever? So.
Someday, Hank, but not at the moment. In fact, the NASA just put into lunar orbit a Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and LRO, yesterday, released its first images of 5 out of the 6 landing sites. And you can see the descent stage on the surface of the planet, and there's even more spectacular, the Apollo 14 mission. You can see the footpath produced by the astronauts. Alan Shepard was the commander of that mission. They had to walk a long distance. They were trying to get to the rim of a crater.
That descent stage, that's what my uncle welded on, was on that descent stage.
Oh, really? Well, you can see that descent stage now in photos that LRO took just this week. They're going to be
that would be even more amazing. I'd love to frame something like that and get to him not know about it.
If you just do a search on the web for Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and any of the Apollo missions, you'll get those pictures. And those pictures for Apollo 14, to me, in my mind, they solve a mystery that's hung over the Shepard mission to the moon now for 40 years, which is Alan Shepard and his partner, whose name escapes me at the moment, but they had a walk, supposed to walk to a crater rim, and it just took too long.
That was Edgar Mitchell.
That's right. And they had to turn around, and they didn't know how close they were to the rim. They thought they were just a few hundred feet, but they weren't sure. Well, these pictures taken just this week show those the footpath, the trail in the dust these two guys made going and coming, and they had gotten very close.
60 feet, I hear.
Say again?
60 feet.
Yeah. And you can see it in the picture. You can actually see it. It's confirmed. It's amazing.
I wonder if they had gotten to the edge, what would have happened?
Well, what would have happened? The original idea was they get to the edge. They would set up their scientific instruments on the edge. They take photos. They get samples in the crater itself, on the edge of the crater. It wouldn't have been dangerous. These craters have relatively shallow steepness. It was a somewhat large crater. They would have taken great pictures, but they didn't get there. Scientists were never quite sure exactly how close they had gotten. We now know. It's amazing.
Okay, next up, let's go to Studio City, California. Enrique, hi there.
Hey, George, Bob Zimmerman, how are you guys doing tonight?
Good.
Pretty good, Enrique.
I had a quick, I was wondering what you guys would probably think if maybe the United States left space shuttles in space and basically used them as what it refers to as a space shuttle things to the moon, shuttle things to Mars. Maybe convert them into a tow sort of type of shuttle, I don't know. I find it kind of ridiculous to store them in the, museum. I don't know what you guys think about that.
Well, storing them in a museum to a certain extent seems wasteful, but you can't, they're not designed to do any, they were designed to travel to and from the Earth. They weren't designed to work in space. They have wings, delta wings, and the thermal systems there. It wouldn't be efficient engineering-wise or practical to try to use them to do other things. They are designed, those shuttles, very effectively to bring cargo up and cargo back. And in fact, when we don't have the shuttle anymore, we will be losing the cargo return capability the shuttle has that no other via vessel at this moment can match. And so that's what they're made for. Now, there's been lots of talk about doing what they call shuttle-derived adaptations of the system. You wouldn't use the shuttle itself. You would create a cargo vessel in place of the shuttle that would be attached to the external tanks and be attached to the solid rocket boosters, and it'd have its own engines, but it would be designed to just go up and bring lots of cargo up there. That's been talked about for decades, actually, and there are people in NASA who have been pushing this, actually, anonymously for the last 4 years. Rather than build the Ares 5 rocket, they say they should do this instead. Once again, you have to think in terms of first decide what you want to engineer and build, and then you build around that. Trying to improvise the shuttle into a vessel to go to Mars would produce poor engineering and wouldn't be very effective. If you want to go to Mars, you have to design the vessel for that. Same thing if you want to build a space station, the shuttle would not really be an effective way to do it. You would actually spend a lot of money and get not a very effective space station in the end result.
Bob Zimmerman, we'll be back with more phone calls for you. Special 2 hours of calls next on Coast to Coast AM. If you haven't signed up yet for the free Coast Zone newsletter, well, go ahead and do that just by going to coasttocoastam.com. Up there in the corner, you can sign up and get that free newsletter delivered right to your computer every morning. And for you StreamLink members, as you now know, there's a letter posted at coasttocoastam.com. Some more new features, including going back into the archives now, one full year, not 90 days, one full year for StreamLink members. You can do that by simply signing up as well at coasttocoastam.com. For you, Robert, what's the greatest mystery of the universe?
Oh, gosh. You have me speechless, George.
Finally, for a change, huh?
I mean, the thing about the universe itself is it's wonderful mystery in total. I mean, every time human beings look more closely at anything, the universe surprises us every single time. So, and in every single area of interest. So to say, what's the greatest mystery? It's the whole game is just an amazing mystery. I mean, what's going on here? If there's a God, he surely gave us a wonderful playground to explore, because he leaves things hidden that we have to dig around. You know, 1,000 years ago, the Earth, it wasn't self-evident that the Earth revolved around the sun. If you look up in the sky, it's absolutely not self-evident. It took very difficult, time-consuming research by many people over many decades, centuries, to finally begin to understand that we're on a globe. And it orbits the sun. And similarly, to understand that the Milky Way galaxy is a galaxy similar to other galaxies, that's not something self-evident or easy. It took a long time to figure that out. And right now, for astronomy, to use an example, the two main big mysteries cosmologically is what dark matter and dark energy. And they're two different things. There is something in the universe, a matter of some kind, something that causes gravity, that causes galaxies to function as if they have a lot more mass than they really do, than they visibly appear to have. So there's some kind of matter out there that we cannot find or identify that has influenced the gravitational fields of galaxies, and we don't know what it is. That's dark matter. And then there's the energy, dark energy, which they don't know what it is. It's just somehow the universe is expanding faster than, instead of slowing down, it's picking up speed, and no one understands why. Those are big mysteries. But, you know, there's little mysteries. I'm a caver, George, and I do cave exploration. And right now, there's something killing bats in the northeast of the United States.
Oh, yeah, we've had that story. It's amazing.
I mean, I've written about that story for Science magazine, specifically. And since I am a caver, I have had personal experience. And I've been with researchers doing the work, so I know a great deal about it. And it's a big mystery. They don't know what it is. A lot of news reports have talked about how it's a fungus killing the bats. But the truth is, they still don't know that. And once again, what is it? This is a mystery. And this is what life is. And it's explore it, to probe the mystery, find out the answer.
Well, what do you think of the Flat Earth Society?
You know, it's a free country. People have the right to their opinions. And, you know, what can I say?
Yeah, but, I mean, don't they see the pictures? Don't they see the round globe as the spaceships pull away?
Well, I could apply the same criteria, my thoughts, to those people as I do those that think the landings on the moon were hoaxes. I mean, you don't see the pictures. The evidence is pretty self-evident. But if people wish to people have a belief system. Sometimes belief systems have nothing to do with facts. And at a certain point, facts have to rule. Well, who was it who said you have the right to your opinion but not to your own facts? And so, you know, but once again, if people wanted that opinion, that's okay.
And what about the 6,000-year Earth creationists?
Well, you know, there's a wonderful scene in the movie, in the play and movie Inherit the Wind, in which they point out that if you look at the 6 days to create the Earth, the sun isn't created until like the third or fourth day. So even if you were taking it literally, those first few days could be any length of time God decides they should be. It's an interesting thing. My heritage is Judaism. I'm not religious, but I know somewhat about this. And Jewish interpretation of the Torah, which is the Genesis, at least the first book of the Torah, Jewish law does not take that stuff literally. It's something to interpret and understand. And I wouldn't take it literally. That's how I look at it. But once again, if someone wants to believe that, that's their freedom, the liberty of conscience. They have the right to believe that.
Okay, next up, let's go to the phones again. Los Angeles. Hello, Joe. Your turn.
Yes, hi, gentlemen.
Hey.
Great show.
Sure thing.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Real well.
Okay.
Loud and clear, Joe.
You know, I wanted to comment on the space program, but you did bring up the bats. And one thing I just want to say real quickly about the bats, I believe it's the same thing that's happened to the bees. I think that's a result of all the massive global spraying, because there are some researchers that have found in the residue of this spray to be contain a lot of pathogens, and one of which is a lot of different types of fungus, mold, spores, and bacterium. But so I'm convinced that's what's killing the bats.
I have to insert here that we can have lots of opinions, but the truth of the matter is that to really understand the question, we have to reserve, I think, at this moment, opinions. Possible of it being a pathogen or spraying, that's absolutely a possibility. There hasn't been yet any evidence to prove that at all. I'd say that's unfortunate, because if we knew that, it would help, but we don't have any evidence.
I can say this with, first-hand knowledge, or seeing it firsthand, that Los Angeles is a complete disaster. Even on clear days, they're just constantly spraying. But in any event, the space program, what about the probability of there being two space programs? The one that we see with the shuttle and the astronauts, that's what the public sees. And then you have the secret space program coming out of places like Area 51, where you see these incredible spacecraft doing all kinds of amazing things, and it's, I don't think it's really much of a stretch to say that, you know, it's pretty much fact at this point that our government has been secretly doing reverse technology on spacecraft and a lot of these facilities and whatnot. So why couldn't we have already done interplanetary travel, of which I've, you know, that's all, there are also rumors and stuff you can read about that, and a lot of stuff I've heard on Coast to Coast over there that makes me look at the space shuttle and say, that's a jalopy. As amazing as it is, I think it's a jalopy compared to what we actually already have, the technology we have with the electromagnetic propulsion and the anti-gravity propulsion. I think the sky, you know, they can go much further than something like the shuttle, don't you think?
No, I don't agree with you in the slightest. In fact, I know quite a bit about the military. The military space program is almost as heavily financed. In some periods of time, it's been more heavily financed than NASA's. But the military's focus is completely different. They're not interested in traveling to other planets. What they want to do is to increase their capability of protecting the United States. They're military people. So, I mean, for example, NASA initially, I'm just reviewing a book on the history of the shuttle, and NASA tried to get the military in on the shuttle, and for a few years, for a period of time, the military was in on the shuttle program, but their interests conflicted, because the only thing the military was interested in is setting up, launching a variety of reconnaissance satellites looking down at the Earth, and those needs conflicted with NASA's, which was sometimes sending out planetary probes. The military has done a lot of things that we don't know about, or at least we don't know in detail about, but it gets out if you do enough digging. Their reconnaissance satellites are very sophisticated. Much of that technology was used to build Hubble. It was revised, but it was used to build Hubble. And the so-called spaceships that people talk about in, quote, Area 51, a lot of that actually is, in retrospect, sightings of things like the stealth bomber. Before anyone knew what it was, you saw that fly overhead, and you'd think it was an alien spaceship. No, I don't agree with you. The military has no interest in going to other planets, because it doesn't serve their number one goal, which is military.
They want to dominate space. That's what they want.
Say again?
They want to dominate space around this planet.
Around this planet, yes. Looking down. That's their goal. It would not be to go. And manned flight, they abandoned manned space flight a long time ago because it's not effective. It's not very cost effective for what they need to do. Most of what they need to do in space can be done in unmanned. If they want to develop anti-satellite technologies, and the United States has actually trailed in this, the Russians and the Chinese have been much more aggressive about doing anti-satellite technology and have aggressively destroyed satellites several times. But if they want to do that, there's no reason to have a manned craft to do it. It's much more expensive. It's much more effective to do it unmanned. And reconnaissance is the same thing. They have found very quickly, very early on, within a year of Sputnik, that a manned program doesn't make any sense. They tried to do a manned orbital laboratory in the early 60s, and they had a major financing. They were going to use the Gemini capsule as their basis. But it got canceled because it made no sense financially for them. They could do much better with unmanned reconnaissance satellites. So, no, I don't agree. We don't have those kind of capabilities. And once again, this gets back to what I said about life on Mars. If such things existed, trust me, it would percolate out into the public sector very quickly, such as Hubble. They had the technology to do very sophisticated big mirrors, and that percolated out into making Hubble. And it wouldn't be kept secret. It would be used in some manner.
All right, next up, let's go to, whose turn is it? Let's go to Tina in Center Wellington, Canada, on the wildcard line. Hi, Tina.
Hi, George. First, I wanted to say I really, really enjoyed your book, and I've been listening to you for about 12 years. So it's nice to talk to you.
Well, I've not been on for 12, but that's pretty good.
Well, it actually started with
Art.
George Bell. So.
Okay.
And then when you came on, I kept listening.
Well, thanks. We see.
But I just want to make one comment before I ask my question. The airborne laser and transformational satellite program is going to be ended. That is what the U.S. Defense Secretary has announced on April 6th. So that's not going to be anything that people think that we're going to be doing anymore, and because that's going to be cut out. And they've also, as I heard, and I also heard on your program, that they're now allowing Germany, they've signed a contract with them to have Germany come in and do four projects with them by 2012 and give them access to their top secret laboratories. So
yeah, I heard that.
Yeah. Well, what I was going to say was that what does your guests think about the fact that the Russians are now partners with China? They've agreed to defend each other. And they've also formed alliances with Japan and India, whom are all of them, China, Russia, Japan, and India, are all very much into the space program thing. So if they're all working together and our chance against all of them, who's going to get there first?
That's a very good question, Tina. Americans, I think, in the last 30 years have become very, very naive in terms of this idea of international cooperation. We all think, and President Obama ran under the premise that he'll be a nice guy and he'll talk and charm his way and everyone will be lovey-dovey. But the truth of the matter is that every international agreement we've signed with every other nation, those nations have taken advantage of our goodwill to benefit for themselves, and they really don't care that much about us. They want their piece of the pie. A good example is the Europeans signed an agreement with us to help build Hubble. They built solar panels and an instrument. The solar panels had to be abandoned immediately because they were faulty. The instrument was replaced in 96, so it wasn't there very long. But in that deal, they got a guaranteed 15% of all observation time. So Europeans get 15% of all Hubble time guaranteed first off the bat, forever. And so it's not just lovey-dovey. So, yes, we have international agreements with the Russians to work on ISS, but we have to stop being naive about their friendship. They're out for their own interests, and we have to protect our own interests as well. That doesn't mean we fight a war, but we have to protect our own interests just like they do. And the reason the Chinese and the Russians have mutual agreements is partly because they're neighbors, and next-door neighbors, and benefits them, partly because they're competing against us and they want to beat us to space. And same thing with the Indians. The Indians, they're not going to get, the Indians have found it's difficult to work with the Americans in this in space stuff. So it's better, it's easier to work with the Russians actually and the Chinese, and so they make deals with them. And the Russians see it a way to make some money. They help the Indians build their spacecraft, and they make some money in, as a consultant. And the Indians get their spacecraft. They found it's much more difficult to work with us in this respect. So it's a concern from my mind. The most important thing is we have to be aware of our own self-interests here. Just because we want to work with everybody else and be nice guys doesn't mean we should, you know, just acquiesce to every demand of others and not protect ourselves.
Okay, next up we go to Tuscaloosa, Alabama. First-time caller. Steven, thanks for holding.
Hey, I had a question about going back to the moon and eventually Mars.
Sure.
Would it not be cheaper and probably faster to take, say, the Saturn V and the Apollo capsules and refit those with modern technology and start there instead of starting from scratch and building a new spacecraft to go to the moon?
Well, the fact is that's exactly what NASA is trying to do right now. The Ares rocket and the Orion capsule are essentially upgraded Saturn V and Apollo capsule designs. They are trying to make them bigger and better and more powerful and more capable, but they are basically going back to that design. But you have to understand that it is 40 years ago. And, for example, the heat shield that was on the Apollo capsule, the companies that made that ablative heat shield that would burn off and protect the astronauts, it wasn't reusable, they don't exist anymore, the companies. The technology, the people that actually made that, they're not around anymore. So NASA has to completely reinvent the wheel from scratch. And in fact, in that case of the thermal protection system of the heat shield, they're having some problems because some of this technology just isn't made anymore anywhere. Sometimes it's a case where other things have come along to replace it, but they don't apply to NASA's needs. So you have to start from scratch. So it's not so simple. Yes, they actually have gone your route, but this is still rocket science. It's going to be difficult to do.
So if you're going to buy a telescope for somebody as a gift, would you buy a reflector or a refractor telescope?
Oh, well, I'm no expert on this subject. I would say first, find out where the local amateur astronomy club is in your area and go to one of their meetings, and you'll have 40 people telling you everything you need to know about every possible telescope in the world.
And still not know which one to buy.
I would say a reflector would be the choice almost routinely, yes.
That's the bigger one that you look kind of like you look down to. Right?
Yes. That's right. A reflector works with mirrors. This is actually something Newton designed. A refractor, you look through lenses.
But straight on.
Straight on. And yeah. For an amateur, generally, either will work, but they have their pluses and minuses. And most amateurs that I've known have owned reflectors of some kind.
I love telescopes.
It's great. Oh, I love going to star parties with amateur astronomers because they gather around, stay up all night looking at the stars, and you can wander around the field and just look at different things, and they're just into it so much.
My folks bought me a little refractor when I was a kid, and I joined a telescope club.
Yeah.
Not in school, but it was a guy who would sell the telescopes had a club there.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, the thing I will always remember about this is the wooden tripod, because what he did, he painted it black, and then he speckled it with white paint. They looked like little stars, and I will always remember that. I would take it out into the harsh winters of Detroit.
Yeah.
It would be 10 degrees above zero,
yeah.
And I'd be out there looking at Jupiter and Mars and Saturn, and I loved every minute of it, Bob.
You know, I was doing exactly the same thing in the winters of Brooklyn, New York.
Yep.
And looking at you know, Orion and Jupiter and Saturn. And, of course, I had a crummy refractive telescope as a kid, and it didn't really show me much. But, you know, and I've been doing so many other things, I haven't really gotten into telescopes. I would love at some point. When I get old and I can't do other cave anymore, I'm going to probably get myself a telescope and just look at the stars.
When I saw the four major moons of Jupiter and the rings of Saturn, I mean, it was just unbelievable. We'll be back with final phone calls with Robert Zimmerman next on Coast to Coast AM.